Hello, this is Sabrina George for newcomedyradio.com. We're sitting in the club having a serious cup of tea, and I'm talking to Henning Venn, who is probably the most famous German comic in the UK, possibly the only German comic in the UK. You have tried, but not many have succeeded. Henning, very first question which I ask everybody, what was the first action you did to become a stand-up comic? What was the first thing you actually did to get into being a stand-up rather than thinking about it for years?
First time that I got in touch with stand-up comedy was because in Germany stand-up comedy is an unknown quantity. So, and when I came over to the UK and lived here, so and then I seen an ad for a local comedy club in Greenwich and what is in Southeast London. So. Went to the comedy night, didn't know what to expect, so it turned out it was a very low-key comedy night. And then I thought, hang on, I could give that a go. So then after that, I treated one of the acts to drink, so and then he gave me a few phone numbers, and that's how it all started, really.
And what made you decide to go to follow that ad up? Why did you want to go and see comedy? Was it because of the reputation of British comedy, or?
It was one of them things, really, where if I would have seen net for something else, I've got no idea what for play or.
So you could have got into Spanish dance in the same way?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
It was just something that you just fell into?
Yeah, and then I seen the, understood the concept quite quickly, someone on stage telling stories or telling jokes, and that appealed to me, and I thought I'd give them a go.
And I'm putting a plug for really, really crap nights. Do you think the fact that it was such a rubbish night was something that encouraged you to think you could do it?
Oh, definitely.
Definitely.
I mean, the poor quality of the night, that definitely was the thing that I thought, yeah, I'm better than that even in a second language. So if I would have gone to a very good comedy night, I would have said, oh yeah, I really like the idea and I would love to do it. But and as it is my second language, I won't be able to do it, what a shame.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and then therefore I'm very, very pleased how it all panned out that I started going to such a horrible night, really.
Such rubbish. Was it like you and five other people in the audience?
Yeah, it was maybe 10-15 people in the audience, so and loads of acts on, so it was a new act night, and that was very encouraging. So there was not really an obstacle between, as having said, I mean, I can only repeat myself, if you go to really perfectly well set up clubs, so and everybody is at their best, let's say, like the comedy show, so and everybody's really good, then I would have said, oh, that is great, and I'd come here, I'll go here regularly, no? But I would not have made the transition of being a stand-up, because then I would have said, okay, because of the language hurdle, unfortunately, it's not possible.
And had you seen any comedy, I'm talking about stand-up comedy, obviously, but that sort of idea, had you seen that in Germany when you were growing up, or had you seen it?
No, not at all.
So not
I
at all?
I was totally unfamiliar with the concept of stand-up.
Really? Mm. Completely?
Yeah.
Really? That's fascinating.
And, we have got things like and similar equivalent to end-of-peer performances. So that is in the time in Carnival's time, so when it is Carnival. And are listeners familiar with Carnival? So basically it's a festivity mainly done by the Catholics, and it's about dressing up, and there is lots of Carnival clubs, so and they've got like their club evenings. And
so they're more like jesters and cabaret performers. I mean, jesters are people who just mess around.
Oh, yes. The ones that are doing their annual nights, the people that perform there, that goes pretty much, that is very similar to 70s British comedy, end of year mother-in-law jokes. So, and I was familiar with them, but because that is so rarely around, because there is not very often Carnival, it's only once a year, so then it's only on for 2 months. and I did live in one of the carnival hotspots anyway, so that was never an opportunity to say, oh, I'll give that a go.
Right.
There and at the carnival.
And were you like the funny person as a child or a teenager? Were you the funny person in your group? Or?
Yeah, I always liked to crack a joke, really.
Right, so yeah. You did know what a joke idea was.
I mean, I must say, I had certain element of... I mean, I wasn't unfamiliar to standing on stage because I used, during the studies, I used to work as a tour guide. So for German tour operators around the Mediterranean Sea and then in the winter in the Alps. And that involved being on stage basically every single day. But that was not stand-up. I didn't have a written routine or anything. That was more like being a pop pair.
Right.
So of what other people did, or say hello to everybody and make them feel welcome and all that. So I was familiar with the concept of holding a mic in the hand and standing on stage and speaking to people.
So that didn't, that wasn't a concern of yours?
No.
Didn't worry at all?
And it never was really a concern. I mean, I've done my first gig, I said, yeah, I'll do a lot more of those. So, because, I mean, I like the writing and I like the performing. So, now that I'm a bit further advanced, so I play up and down the country, comes the third element. I really enjoy traveling. So, and stand-up combines all three. Mm. So, and whenever I do a gig out of town, it's a lot of comics that do a gig, let's say 300 miles away from London or from wherever they live, so, and do the gig and climb back in the car, drive back to London, I'm back 6 o'clock in the morning or something. That would be something I would not enjoy at all. So what I try to do is to get an early train up to wherever I perform, take my bicycle with me and go cycling and stay in a B&B and then the next day go cycling again or do some other sort of sightseeing and then in the afternoon go back on the train back to London.
So you get a sort of a little bit of a tourist view from an odd perspective of the comedian cyclist.
Yeah, I mean, it's because Britain is a lovely country. Mm. It's beautiful. Mm. So, if it wouldn't be for the people. No. It's such a beautiful country. So, and I just think it's such a waste of an opportunity if you just go up there in a car, drive to the venue, walk in there, 20 minutes, one room looks like the other anyway, so you go in there 20 minutes, then vomit that out, and then back in the car, and back to London, and then you're in bed at 6 in the morning. I mean, so that doesn't appeal to me at all.
Doesn't work at all, yeah. So why did you come to Britain?
Always really because of the food, isn't it? No. I always worked in football marketing, and got a job here at Wycombe Wanderers Football Club, and was working in Germany for Bayer Erdingen, so what used to be a top flight team, and they were in European semis in the mid 80s, so I worked for them, but they basically unfortunately had written insolvency all over them, and I thought, I'll tell you what, I'll go over to England and try to improve my English, so because I only have very basic school English, and I thought, yeah, that really is something I should work on. Let's go over to the UK for a couple of months. So then I applied to the 92 league clubs, football league clubs here in Britain, and so done a couple of interviews in and around London, and so then was very lucky that Wycombe Wanderers, they got to, for the first time ever, they got a CEO in, so in the end was very strong in marketing Britain, so and I had a strong marketing background, so and then it all went from there. He said, yeah, you come here for a few months, so and initially I wanted to go back after 5 months, that was the plan, so that I enjoyed it here. And then, so I stayed on for a bit, then I bumped into stand-up.
And so how long were you here before you got into stand-up? Before you went to that gig in Greenwich?
About a year, I would say, a year. So I came over in 2002. I came over in March 2002, so and I started doing stand-up in October 2003, so that makes it a year and a half.
Because when I met you first, your English still was quite minimal, to put it politely.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought it was quite extraordinary that you managed to build up a 5-minute set, which was good. in English. So how did you do that?
Yeah, basically just use old German jokes.
You did.
Translate them, and then let's see. I mean, it's nothing funnier than jokes anyway, isn't it?
So, then I got that twist of explaining the jokes, and I've done a lot of things without really, that really worked out very well without realizing why. It appealed to me that it's funny. So, and then it turned out, okay, that also fits into a German stereotype. For example, when I start my set, always press a stopwatch that I wear around my neck. And the reason that I started that was that I don't wear a watch, so I don't wear a wristwatch, and I never had a clue how long I was on for. So I must address that. And I said, I tell you what, I get myself a stopwatch. Put that around my neck. Now it also turns out that it's a very good shop.
It's a brilliant piece of material.
Yeah, that just backs up my German credentials. So it explains a lot of things. I told old jokes and explained them. So that was basically the way I told and I tell jokes in German. So if we're in a pub in Germany and I tell a joke, so then I tell the joke and then I'll explain it to everybody. So that was, and then I'll do that over here, and then also lives up to the stereotype of being extremely efficient or whatever. So I mean, it just fits into,
logical, yeah.
Yeah.
Your first year here, were you aware of the stereotype, or was it something you knew in Germany that you had the stereotype to deal with? Or didn't you really know to what degree the Brits had these ludicrous stereotypes of what German people were like?
To realise the extent and the obsession of the British with the German, that took me quite some time to realise. And in so many aspects, so for example, you're German and then you speak with a British person, would they, you must be a hardcore supporter of David Hasselhoff. So then I thought, in the first few times, I thought, the person is barmy, so he's not all there, the person that speaks. And then I got
by the time the 30th person says it.
Said, there must be a pattern there. So what is it about us and David Hasselhoff? With lots of things, I'm sure you don't have a sense of humour. So then I was basically personally offended. But why would the people say that? So until I realised that it's a stereotype. For example, the whole war obsession from the British, that is something I wasn't aware of at all. I remember I had my first day at Wickham Wanderers, and they had a good old club secretary, John Goldsworth, his name, brilliant, brilliant fella. He was well in his 80s, and because he wanted still to be involved with the club, so they're giving him a desk there and some things to do. So, and then on his desk, it was two big posters. One was of Spitfire and the other one of Hurricane. And that is the first day I walked in there in the office. And that chap, without any malice, hello, nice to meet you. So friendly as friendly as one can imagine. Obviously, that's the thing, I mean, with all those war obsession and stereotypes and all that, I always think the British don't have any malice. I mean, it is without malice, and so therefore I don't mind it. So another one was when Wickham, they had like a lottery canvasser. So that gentleman was well in his 80s, yeah? And then he always wore he always wore a top emblazoned with the Royal Air Force logo. So then he said to me, hello, where are you from in Germany? I said, yeah, I'm from Hagen. So what is it, Ruhr Valley? So then he said, yeah, I know Hagen, but only from the air. my tongue had been completely flattened during the Second World War.
And he was
without any malice. That was just, I know it, but only from the air.
It's like I did a gig in a prison once, and I sort of knew they probably were murderers because it was long term. And this guy said, whereabouts are you from in London? And I said, oh, I'm south of the river. And he said, where's the river? And it occurred to me that he'd lived in London for 15 years, but he didn't know London because he only knew it from being in the prison, which I thought was a... It's obvious, but you don't think about that.
Nah.
You know, where have you lived the last 15 years? In London, but he wasn't in London, he was in a prison. So it's like one of those bizarre
So did everybody laugh? Or was it more like...
Well, I was the only one talking to him, so so I was trying not to laugh. I was just going, God, yeah, that actually makes sense. It's completely bizarre. It's like someone knowing Hagen extremely well, but at night.
So did you perform to an audience of one then?
No. They were... I was being asked to direct something, so I went to see a show that they were already doing.
Oh, I see.
And they were all long-term prisoners, and I was trying to... We were both trying to not talk about what his offence was and not talk about... So it was one of those sort of general chit-chats of like, oh, so where do you live? Well, south of the river. Where's the river? And suddenly you realise they have no idea what that means. So, because I find it interesting when I've just been in Amsterdam, and one of the things I find more Scandinavian countries actually than outside, but the other countries, northern European countries, have an obsession about British being imperialist, who constantly invade, take over, have no qualms about, you know, shooting people. And it's something that it's happened so often now that I've realised that it must be true. It's not like a one-off, that's the view of northern Europeans, which is fair enough if that's their view, which I find, and that we're chronic hypocrites. That's the other thing that they constantly get, you British are hypocrites, which again, you know, is... I'm not really bothered. I find it kind of interesting. So did you find it kind of interesting, or did you initially sort of go, oh, for God's sake, leave it out?
Nah, it was more like... I felt like being in an enclosure or in a zoo, and then just watching all the peculiar people, I really enjoy being here, and I enjoy looking at what the people do. So because whatever the British do, it just doesn't work. So that's the thing that is so funny. So, but they always put so much effort and so many rules and try to implement everything. So, and they try so hard, but still nothing works. And that's funny.
From a German perspective.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is about stereotypes is about the British, for example. I mean, the British have got very clearly defined stereotypes about us Germans, yeah, not having a sense of humour or wearing short leather trousers, could step up and down high streets or all that. The other way around, the German is so difficult to pin down British stereotypes about the British, because it's this big class divide in British society on the one hand, and that is mirrored in the stereotypes. You have, on the one hand, you have got that what you would call maybe the upper 10,000, the upper class, so with bowler hat and mansion and fox hunting and all that, so you see them. And then you meet the Brit, the proper Brit. So there is goes abroad and around the
trashy's bars.
Those two things, they are so many worlds apart that it is impossible to just narrow down the British to one piece, really.
I think that's true when people get here, but when they're overseas, they tend to see the one or the other.
Yeah, but still, it is. I mean, the British are still regarded as having manners and stiff upper lip and all that, and the Queen and 5 o'clock tea and
4 o'clock, darling, 4 o'clock.
Oh, is it 4 o'clock? oh dear. For example, in Germany, there is one product. It's called. It's like a mint chocolate. Tastes awful. So it's a mint chocolate, and it's called After Eight. So they always have got big television adverts. So in them adverts, you basically see them always the bowler hats and try to portray Britain as very classy. So, and then you have got that concept of Britain as being very, very classy. So then you come here to London, and then you think they must be joking. So because, I mean, when I came over, I lived in High Wycombe, and...
North
on the outskirts. So, and that is already lovely countryside. So then you can go for your bike ride and cycle through the hills and all that. It's fantastic. Yeah. So, and and then really the big culture shock comes when you go to London. So, and I mean, especially is the big culture shock is probably the multicultural London is, how multicultural. So just in regard to the people I had in my life, I had seen 5 black people before I came to London. So, and then imagine me in London. So what? So, and therefore, whenever I've got friends, well, we always go to Brixton Market. So because I say you won't believe that. So, and then we go around there, and then really they can't believe it. They really So everybody, it's just not something you expect to see. So
that was one of the big scandals about the film of Notting Hill. There were no black people in it, and it's was one of the blackest areas of London, and there was no black people in it. It's this big, bit of a scandal about it. But yeah.
Well, for example, I never in my life, other than on telly, I've never seen in my life someone wearing a turban or anything. So and then just you can see everywhere. So and that's quite fascinating.
Yeah. And do you find when you're travelling around different parts of Britain that you get generally... I'm just going to have to say this. No. Heading's got a card saying...
No, you
friendly.
Don't say any of that.
You are friendly. When you're travelling around, do you find that you're generally accepted... just as a German person with, as I say, people making stereotypical responses to you, but without malice?
Yeah. What was the question then?
Do you find that that's true generally when you're travelling around, or do you find that there are odd pockets where people do get quite antagonistic or try and involve you in heavy debates about what happened before you
not
were born?
Really. No.
Right, that's good. Now, the other thing that I remember you saying, whether it's true or not, when you started, you used to sit in pubs and listen to English pub jokes and write them down and then try and translate them because sometimes you didn't understand them. Is that true?
I wouldn't put it past me, but...
Because I love that image of you sitting there with a German-English dictionary trying to work out some of these pub jokes.
Now, I mean, the story about pub jokes, that is quite an interesting topic that you raised there. Because British think they've got such a unique sense of humour. And then you look, for example, at the pub jokes. I mean, all the pub jokes, I can tell you, from Germany, I've heard them all before. But likewise, all the pub jokes I've been told over here, them the first time 20 years ago in Germany, I mean, they're just the same. Just for some taboo topics over here, Princess Diana, and in Germany, Final Solution. So and people tend not to joke about that. But other than that, jokes are exactly the same. So it's not surprising because I mean, we all get born, we all die, and we have to fill the bits and pieces
fill
in between.
Fill the space, yeah.
Fill the space. So there is it's only a limited amount of things you can joke about.
Well, I heard. One theory, which I quite like about the British and the sense of humour, is that the British put humour into absolutely everything, whereas most other cultures don't. And generally, the more serious the subject, the more light-hearted we treat it. And the more light-hearted the subject, the more serious we treat it. So we take our tabloid press, for instance, incredibly seriously. But we take something like, I don't know, the latest scandal of a minister doing something incredibly lightheartedly. Whereas other cultures tend to take serious things seriously and lighthearted things seriously. Lighthearted. And I think that's what gives the impression that we're a very humorous nation. We just put it everywhere. We don't have, even in a business meeting, constantly management is told in British management guides, put humour in, whereas other cultures don't do that.
Yeah, but that is quite interesting because that is the point I would like to make, is that there is always a lot of talk about humour, So, and the British are world class in marketing themselves as being brilliant at humour, without even telling many jokes. Not telling many jokes, but they're just constantly saying, we are great, in a very serious manner. We are great in when it comes to humour, without proving that.
So you think the German stereotype is lack of good marketing?
Definitely has got a lot to do with that. Definitely. I mean, it's like the perception that British have got such good manners. That's got a lot to do with, I don't know, it would be interesting to explore that more, but somebody somewhere must have done something right in convincing the world that the British have got excellent manners.
Well, there was a poll that came out last week, a European poll, saying that the rest of Europe perceived Britain to have the best manners in Europe, but the British perceived themselves to have the least good manners.
Yeah, because you know yourself.
Well, not much.
This saying, oh, sorry, that implies that there are good manners, but it's just British know that nobody means it. Yeah, you can say, oh, yeah, sorry, but it's no regret, it's just a word to say to get yourself out of hassle.
Yeah, which you're brilliant at. And that's where I think the stereotype of us being hypocrites, or that's what Europeans think of us as hypocrites, comes from. We don't actually mean anything we say, including our good manners. Which is,
that is for a foreigner, that is the hardest thing, I can tell you that one. That is the thing, the whole concept of faint praise and understanding, really working out what is meant, that is very difficult, very, very difficult. You may know all the words, still doesn't give you, you're never sure whether that really is what people say or whether it's exactly the opposite.
The hidden agenda.
I wouldn't call it a hidden agenda, but it's just that I think you have to be British to fully understand what the other person is telling you.
Right.
And so because I had that once, is that someone said to me, it was after a comedy competition that I won, of course. Then somebody saying then to me, oh, you must have been surprised that you won. And I still don't know what would have been the right reaction to that. No, I fully expected to win. What I know was exactly the wrong thing to say.
Instead of being the Germanic, well, of course, I'm not surprised, yes. Of course I was going to win.
Yeah. that is the thing, that is so difficult to really work out what you really mean.
Yeah. It's one of the things, because I worked in Germany quite a bit on and off, and one of the things that someone explained to me finally, she was actually American, that in English, all languages, we, like when we go and order a piece of a loaf of bread, for instance, we'll go up to a shop, would it be possible for you to give me a nice brown loaf of bread? And what the Germans hear, if you directly translate it, sounds really dodgy. It sounds like you're being manipulative. So actually what the correct thing that the Germans feel comfortable with is a much more honest, give me a loaf of bread. And then they feel like, oh, this is a straightforward person.
Peter. I can do it.
Please.
Yeah.
Yes, you can say please, that's acceptable. But if you try and do the English thing of maybe, would it be possible for perhaps you could get me a loaf of bread?
We don't have time for all that. More customers waiting to be served.
Even if you're the only one in the shop, we've still got something important to do.
Yeah.
But it really woke things up for me, and I started to realise that actually me trying to be in English terms polite came across as like a ducking and diving, manipulative, undirect, you know, somebody really dodgy. And as soon as I cleared that up, and it was quite uncomfortable to start off with, to actually ask for what you want in the most direct way, and say things in the most direct way and stop putting in all these possiblys, maybe, perhaps, would it be you, very nice person, could you, that it just made them go, God, this person's, you know, some real dodgy con artist.
Yeah, and then I come across quite rude over here, so I know that fully well. So I just can't say you said that. Oh, that is a very kind offer. You say no.
Not on your Nelly.
Yeah, not on your Nelly.
We're going to stop it there for a minute because that's the end of part one. Thank you.